Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, May 1st, 2017. A technical group of the proposed UN Regional Protection Forces arrived in Juba this weekend.
These forces are not part of the African, they are not part of the region, and we see no reason why they should come. The reason they gave us was that these are technical people whose abilities are not available in the region.
And the Kiir administration forms a crisis committee to deal with hunger.
If they rectify the situation of the security in the country, we may actually incur a lot of losses to other countries than things that, suppose when we are producing within the country, then the other budget that we are using for importing other things from the other country will have been used for other developmental purposes.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. An advanced team of the Regional Protection Force arrived in Juba over the weekend. The UN mission in South Sudan says a team of engineers are in the country to prepare for the deployment of 4,000-strong force in the capital with a mandate to protect civilians. As Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba, the government says it will accept regional troops from neighboring countries to be part of the UN peacekeeping force in South Sudan.
The Regional Protection Force, or RPF, was established in 2016 by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2304. UNMISS released a statement over the weekend saying, the RPF headquarters has been established in Juba under the leadership of Brigadier General John Mpenzi from Rwanda. The statement says, an advance party of a construction engineering company from Bangladesh arrived on April 20th, bringing essential equipment to begin preparing offices for the RPF in Juba. Regional troops from Rwanda are expected to follow in June and July. The UNMISS statement says, the RPF will provide coordinated protection to key facilities in Juba and protection to the main routes into and out of the city. The force will also strengthen the security of UN protection of civilian sites and other UN premises, according to the statement. South Sudan's Information Minister Michael Makwey confirmed to VOA that a team of engineers has arrived in the country.
The team of engineers is already here to come and construct the infrastructure for the RPF.
Makwey says the Kiir administration objects to the presence of any non-African forces as part of the regional protection force and only gave permission for the Bangladeshi forces to enter the country because of their technical expertise.
We had raised that these forces are not part of the African, they are not part of the region, and we see no reason why they should come. The reason they gave us was that these are technical people whose abilities are not available in the region.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan operates under Chapter 7 of the United Nations. Under Chapter 7, the Security Council shall determine the existence of any threat to the peace, breach of the peace or act of aggression, and shall make recommendations or decide what measures shall be taken to restore international peace and security. Makwey says his government will not accept combat troops who are not from the region to be part of the RPF.
It is only the technical part that will be handled by non-regional force. But the rest of the force is supposed to come in as Africans, not only Africans but from the region.
UNMISS says the deployment of the RPF will free up existing UNMISS peacekeepers to extend their presence to conflict-affected areas beyond Juba. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
The South Sudan government has acknowledged hunger is spreading across the country. Last week, the cabinet formed a committee headed by the first vice president, Taban Dengai, to look into the problem and try to find solutions. Residents of Juba say similar committees were formed by the government in the past to look at the root cause of inflation. But the ongoing economic crisis continues. Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Minister for Information and a Government Spokesman Michael Makwe says South Sudan suffers from what he terms a hunger gap as well as a looming famine and is dealing with both.
The government will be buying a stock of food from Reng and transport them to the needy parts of South Sudan. It has also paid a sum of $1 million to Ramshell Company. And Ramshell Company is a company that is indigenous, established here in South Sudan. It is supposed to import food items for $1 million. Probably some of part of it might have arrived now at the borders and they will be crossed into South Sudan soon. The Ministry of Finance has also released a sum of $2 million for purchase of food items for the army.
Makwe says the government has also received a donation of 10,000 metric tons of sorghum from the Eritrean government and about 2,000 bucks from the Almagani family of Sudan. He says the government is also purchasing 10,000 metric tons of maize from Tanzania and notes all food items imported to South Sudan will be tax-free. And Makwe says an emergency committee led by the first vice president, Taban Dengai, was formed by the cabinet to address the food crisis.
The task of this body is to come up with the mechanisms, sit down, organize, study, and come up with the monitoring and control mechanisms for the incoming food and plan also for any further food that will be coming into the country so that we see how best we can move out of this situation.
Families across the country are struggling to put food on the table for their loved ones. Many government employees received salaries recently after staying for several months. Juba resident Lodo Ahmed Festo says ongoing fighting in the country has destabilized agricultural activities and the business sector. He says the government needs to do more than form more committees and talk about the crisis.
The most important thing is the security. If they rectify the situation of the security in the country, I think some of the other measures even will just drop itself alone. Because things that we normally import from outside is really more useless actually than the thing that we produce within our country. Because we may actually incur a lot of losses to other country than things that, suppose when we are producing within the country, and then the other budget that we are using for importing other things from the other country will have been used for other developmental purposes for our community.
Juba resident and activist Koiti Emily does not believe any measures put in place by the government have addressed the economic problems. She says the 2015 peace agreement reforms must be enforced.
Any solution to this, to the economic situation that falls short of resolving the political feuds and eventually resolving the conflict, if there is nothing of the sort, it will not solve this economic problem.
Emily says the Petroleum Revenue Act and the Petroleum Management Act are not transparent as far as revealing how the country's main revenue source is being spent.
Within the Petroleum Revenue Management Act, we are supposed to have the petroleum revenue accounts. There are two accounts under that. And ordinarily, we are supposed to have those accounts audited. But since initiation, those accounts have never been audited. So we cannot keep track of how much is coming in and how much we have utilized and where has it gone.
Earlier this year, the government formed a committee to address the root causes of South Sudan's out-of-control inflation. That committee has yet to make its findings public. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Hundreds of internally displaced persons who fled fighting in Raja town 2 weeks ago arrived in Wau town this week. The group, composed of women and children, are camping at the UN and Catholic Church compounds in Wau. The IDPs say hundreds of families are still trying to survive in the bush around Raja town. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
Rebecca Natale is one of the IDPs. She says she had to work for an entire week with her seven children. Speaking in Arabic to the Catholic-owned Voice of Hope radio in Wau, Natale says they could no longer stay in Raja town because there is no food or water there.
Natale
says all civilians have left the town. Those who remain there are not many. She first thought of going to the North Sudan, but she could not make it because, she says, I have small kids. But hundreds of people keep on leaving the town. So I decided to come to Wau. Natale tried to come with public means, but she could not afford the ticket price, which is 3,500 South Sudanese pounds per person. We just decided to walk to Wau, she says. Fighting erupted between the rebel forces of the SPLA-IO and the government in Raja town 3 weeks ago. Dozens were killed and thousands fled the town in all directions, including crossing the border to Sudan. Carmela Angelo also just arrived in Wau with her four children after spending more than a week on the way to Wau. Speaking in Arabic, she describes what it was like to be in Raja town when she left with her children. Angelo says, if you remain in the town, soldiers will come and threaten you, and they will take away everything, including mattresses. She asks, why should I stay in such a situation? She says, that is why she decided to walk and come to Wau. Angelo says, we are not alone. There are many people still on the way in Mangaya, Damziber, and many other places. I just need to get some food for my kids, Angelo says. Both Natale and Angelo says Raja is no longer safe because there is no food to eat in the market and all Sudanese traders have left the town. With Atala Alamin, a community leader at the POC camp in Wau, confirms about 35 families have just arrived at the camp. Speaking in Arabic, Alamin says many IDPs are in poor health and need immediate medical attention.
People who came from Raja are facing many problems. They came with many children, and they don't have any shelter nor food, and they keep on arriving on a daily basis. Each family has between 5 to 6 children, and if their number keep on increasing, the space in the camp will not be enough.
The Catholic Church in Wau also confirms that at least 17 families came to their compound this week seeking food and shelter. Father Moses Peter Joseph, the humanitarian coordinator in Wau Diocese, says the church compound is full. There is no more space to accommodate additional families. Wau Town Mayor Mel Aleu Goch denied having any information about the arrival of new IDPs from Raja and is awaiting word from the government's Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Wau.
No, you see, these people, sometimes they don't come and report to the government. They only just come and enter into the Yilmaz camp without our reports. So up to now, I never hear an IDPs coming from Raja.
Alamin says hundreds of IDPs arriving from Raja town will join the already nearly 30,000 displaced people in Wau. The number is expected to grow because of the ongoing fighting between the South Sudan Army and rebels loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we look at a peace agreement signed between armed groups and the state government in Yei River State. That story is coming up next.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how do you handle criticism?
Well, with criticism, it depends whether it is a constructive criticism or it is a destructive criticism. When it is a constructive criticism, you take it so that you make some changes in your own life.
How I do handle criticism is by having confidence by myself in everything that I do. As long as I've done it in a perfect way, that's it.
I don't look at a criticism as something that should let me down. Even if somebody is criticizing me for doing something wrong, I take it in a positive way.
If the criticism is better, I handle it with care and I receive the criticisms happily because I know that it is for my own good.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. As the 6 months sanction review period nears its end in July, the United States will have to decide if it will keep former President Barack Obama's decision to ease some sanctions against Sudan. Congressional lawmakers had a second hearing on the sanctions this month, this time by the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa. David Ditoni, director of Washington, D.C.-based Operations for Sudan Relief Fund, was one of the panelists last week. He told the committee the Trump administration should extend Obama's executive order so that the government can maintain its leverage on the Sudan government to respect human rights.
We of all countries shouldn't have to incentivize Bashir and his government to do the right thing for his own people, meaning stop killing your own people. But, you know, we live in a real world and we're trying to make a difference. And so that's something I think we can build on. And I said, for this reason, I would recommend to the Trump administration to extend the sanctions being lifted, that the executive order from President Obama did in January, by 180 days, but let's put some conditions on it.
One of the arguments that I hear a lot is that the sanctions hurt more of the civil society than they hurt the actual government. Have you heard that before? And what's your reaction to that?
That's always the argument about, are sanctions effective and do they hurt the average person more than help the average person? Without, you know, going into, you know, combat or covert action or any other, you know, weapons of state, you know, this is a way to limit, potentially hostile government around the world and what they are, you know, can do potentially to, you know, kind of grow and aggravate harm or do things that are inimical to American interests. So I think sanctions are an essential tool to be used carefully and wisely. With the greater good in mind, that hopefully a government that has committed atrocities or done things that deserve sanctions will be essentially taught or punished and will come around to better governing their own people.
The six-month trial period is coming up in July. What is your recommendation to the Trump administration as well as members of Congress?
I want Congress to have more of a role. The Obama administration essentially left Congress out of any sort of role, even in, you know, consenting or as far as within the specifically within the executive order sort of. So I'd like Congress to have more of a role in the approval process. I recommended that the president amend the executive order to make, there's a report that is required by the Secretary of State to be given to the president, so President Trump, on or before July 12th. On or before means State Department could deliver it to the president and to the public July 11th and still, or even July 12th, and then it's a report that's supposed to kind of summarize progress made on all these issues. And I think that's when the window of lifting these sanctions is up. So I would amend that and make the report due 2 months earlier. I would also make the sanctions not automatically lifted if the president doesn't issue or amend the previous executive order. I would condition them to 180 days. And I would do that or even a year so that the Trump administration can get their own personnel in.
That's David Ditoni, director of the Washington-based Operations for Sudan Relief Fund. She spoke to Ayane Bior last week. A group of armed men claiming to be SPLA-IO forces in Nyeri River State have signed another peace deal in the Ugandan capital over the weekend. Last month, an evangelical Presbyterian church, with support from American-based group, brokered a controversial agreement with an armed group in Nyeri River State. Daniel Friday Martin has more for VOA from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Senior Army commanders who claim to be from the SPLA-IO Division 2 Brigade operating in Morobo and Ye counties joined elders from Koboko, Uganda and South Sudan to witness the signing of the peace deal. The agreement continues a controversial peace accord signed last month. The state government and a group of armed youth, whose affiliation is questionable, agreed to end hostilities and to start an honest dialogue about peace. Bishop Elias Taban of the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, who mediated the talks, outlined the resolutions.
The warring parties discussed restoration of peace, commit the presidential amnesty to armed groups who have desisted all sorts of hostilities and accepted dialogue, agreed to open all roads leading to Ye town out of Ye town to enable movement of people and their properties, to open corridors for access of humanitarian relief assistance, the SPLA-IO of Ye River State to have complete command and control of their forces. For trust-building purpose, the 3rd Brigade, Matianganyoro Army, in Ombasi, Morobo, Kaya, Ye town, and Kegulu, be replaced by another force.
Ye River State Governor David Lokonga Moses says his government is ready to implement all resolutions and terms of the agreement. A self-appointed SPLA-IO representative in Ye River State Brigadier General Hilary Akani says his group welcomes the peace process and asked state authorities to observe the cessation of hostilities.
The government should respect what we have agreed and what we signed. We have to commit ourselves to implement. The paper and pen alone is not enough. It has to go with practical steps so that we are able to achieve and give a gift to our people, the civilians, children and women who are suffering, so they can be able again to get hope and continue with life. I also want to say to the world out there, the South Sudanese in the diaspora, and as you hear from my voice this evening, nobody can hijack our rights and nobody can lead us into a channel that does not bring good fruits to our people.
Majur Mawal, a senior diplomat at the South Sudanese Embassy in Uganda, says dialogue is the best solution to resolving the South Sudanese crisis.
Our people of South Sudan have suffered enough by wars, so this is credible and appreciation that we can give to our brothers in the SPLA-IO of Ye River by accepting to come on the table and negotiate. This is the only way that we can achieve and bring peace to South Sudan through dialogue.
The SPLA-IO leadership allied to former first vice president Riek Machar have distanced themselves from the group that signed a peace deal with Ye River authorities. Machar's office manager told South Sudan in Focus that the group which signed the peace deal last weekend does not represent the SPLA-IO. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday-Martin in Kampala.
South Sudanese refugees who ran from violence in South Sudan say they expect the national dialogue to bring an end to the more than 3 years of fighting in the country. The refugees say South Sudan's political leaders should talk about corruption, tribalism, and the crisis affecting the country. Mungume Dave Surakarinj has this report for VOA from Arua, Uganda.
This past week, President Salva Kiir Mayardit issued an executive order appointing a steering committee for the reconstitution of the national dialogue. Mr. Kiir said last year the committee shall develop the agenda for the dialogue, steer the dialogue process, and work closely with experts and resource persons to help facilitate the process. 50-year-old Dukan Yal, who lives in the Rhino settlement, says he came from Western Upper Nile State to stay with the relatives in Juba when fighting broke out in July last year. Speaking in local Arabic, Niel says he does not know the whereabouts of his 9 children and his wife.
This is the beginning of the peace. When this dialogue comes, everyone should be involved. There must be involvement of the every community in the country. We also have to speak the truth and we have to trust each other. This is the only way we can attain peace.
Jacob Onial, who lives in the Katiwan refugee settlement in Arua, agrees that South Sudanese have suffered much because of the more than three-year-long conflict, and the fighting must stop.
I would like to encourage or to request my leaders in South Sudan that to reconcile to one another everything that has been done to them. So all of us need to reconcile and accept the problem that we have been come across, the destruction we did to our country. We need to accept it and say that we come to a common understanding.
John Jal, a youth leader in the Rwanda Refugee Settlement, came from Jonglei State in 2013. He says the country's youth ought to be involved in the national dialogue.
Let them hear the voices of the youth, because we are the one fighting. They come and mobilize us. You go and fight senseless war that you don't even know the reason why you are fighting.
50-year-old Simon Sule, who ran to Uganda from Kajokeji in February this year, says all warring parties must be involved in the national dialogue. He says making peace is not easy, but it can be done.
I think the major issue is the economic crisis, which needs to be addressed, and then the security problem. These key major issues, if it's been addressed, I think peace will come to the South.
President Kiir has said he intends to exhaust all means in order to achieve peace in South Sudan. But presidential spokesman Atenyuek Ateny and Information Minister Michael Makuei told VOA rebels will not be part of the national dialogue unless they publicly renounce violence before the dialogue begins. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
Today is May Day, a day when many countries celebrate workers. In sub-Saharan Africa, about three-fourths of those laborers work in an informal sector without contract or job protection, according to the International Labour Organization. For VOA News, Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi on the struggles of those workers continue to face.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta pledged to tackle high unemployment during his speech at the annual May Day celebrations. 100 metres away, 31-year-old Christine Dunge continues with her work selling sodas and snacks. She has been a street vendor at this public park in central Nairobi for several years. She says these days getting a job is hard. I have decided to employ myself so that I can survive. Like now, it is a rainy season. There are not enough customers to buy drinks. I motivate myself to continue selling because there is nowhere else I can work. In his address Monday, President Kenyatta announced that Kenya will be raising its minimum wage by 18%. The crowd cheered, but analysts say policies like raising the minimum wage won't help the majority of the workforce. According to the Kenyan government's 2017 economic survey, 833,000 jobs were created last year, but less than 20% of those jobs were in the formal sector. Kwame Owino is the CEO of the Institute of Economic Affairs in Kenya.
There's that disconnect. So on the one side, we have unions, which are talking for people who are in the formal sector, raising wages. And when that happens, when wages are raised from standard economics, one of the first things that happened is employment shrinks. So that employment shrinks in the formal sector, and most of these people fall back to the informal sector. We are solving the wrong problem.
He said Kenya and other African countries need to improve conditions for entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs in Africa often struggle to raise capital. Owino said what governments can do is to create new regulations, making it easier for small business to get loans. He said policymakers can also streamline the process of registering and running a legal business and make it cheaper. Kenya's national anthem played, signalling to the end of the celebration, and Josephat Mwendo, a trained mechanic, prepares to leave the park. After years of looking for a job, the 32-year-old just started fixing cars for money himself. He now has three people he pays to help him. He says, "I don't feel good because they did not speak about people like us. I think it is good to think about those who have employed themselves too, so that they can know their worth and also feel they are Kenyans like the rest." The problem is particularly acute among young people. A recent study by the Brookings Institute found that Africans between the ages of 15 and 24 are just a third of the continent's total working age population, but account for nearly two-thirds of the continent's unemployed. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
That report by Mohammed Yusuf from Nairobi brings us to the end of our show today. We now leave you with the song Being Dull by Vivian. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here. We hope you can join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.